Shall we begin? So, just because outside just now had some questions, so just to repeat, catch up where we ended up last time, Hegel's version of what's called the emptiness charge against Kantian universalism is that the capacity for the moral law to become determinate depends upon antecedent institutional agreements. For example, the question of property. What makes stealing wrong? Is not the universal moral law, but that we have the institution of property. That is, it can only get its grip once we've agreed on certain institutional practices. So the movement from reason to spirit that this is meant to generate is dependent upon a movement from abstract universality, the very idea of the moral law, to some concrete we who have come to some sort of arrangement whereby we have agreed upon certain institutional practices. And it's only in light of them that we can have universal form. So, and again, I'm just summarizing now, that the failure of universalism is that it's much more of a concrete historical achievement than Kant acknowledges, that it's actually only a certain people at a certain time and a certain place with a certain history that can have the idea of real universality. And that notion of real universality, even so, only kicks in, only is effective when there are the types of institutions, above all legal and political institutions, to give them significance. So that universality is always parasitic upon, formal universality is actually always parasitic on substantive universality. Because I said that to him, Habermas didn't talk to me for 10 years. But skip that. He just hated that idea. Okay. Now, the way, and then I want to continue with the summary from last time. Now, the way in which Kantian reason actually came to crisis is not exactly the way in which Hegel maps this transition, although it's continuous with it. It again concerns the idea of the radical independence of reason in Kant. Now, roughly, what was first worked out in the modern era in a systematic way, above all, first in the project of modern science, and then in the project of modern moral universalism, and Kant's two critiques are attempts to give transcendental legitimacy to these two practices. Right? So what Kant was trying to do was to ground
in transcendentalism, the accomplishments of modernity. Now, what these two achievements represent is the idea of, what shall I call it, the impersonal point of view. What is sometimes called the view from nowhere, or the third person point of view, or the outsider or spectator's point of view, or, as we sometimes use it, the neutral point of view. All of these are getting through the idea that modernity was trying to get rid of anything that would be restrictive, so that the idea of modernity was that somehow individuals in our scientific and moral practices could achieve a God's eye perspective on the world. And from that perspective, subjectivity, with all its desires and urges and inclinations and emotions on the one hand, and sociality, which is always parochial and provincial on the other, are regarded as forms of deficiency, as sources of error. Modern science and moral universalism, right, gave urgency to that very old idea. An idea, of course, that's first there in Plato, right? But they gave it really some substance. And Kant is the spokesman of all of that. But this great idea, I said, clashes with another great modern idea. And that's the idea of subjectivity and inwardness. Above all, with the idea that nothing can be valid, nothing can be authoritative for any individual, which that individual, him or herself, does not take as authoritative. That is, individuals are inherently self-determining and self-legislating. And there's nothing higher than the individual. And that idea, we've seen over and over again how it developed, right? From God becomes man becomes the Pope, the priest, finally Luther becomes his own priest, finally with Luther in faith, and the cogito, we ground that notion of subjectivity. Now, those two ideas of modern universalism and the discovery of subjectivity, what makes Descartes and Kant so breathtaking is that they attempted to unify those two things. That is, both Descartes and Kant tried to demonstrate that the very kernel of the subject, as you go into the most innermost recess of the subjectivity of the subject, you get not subjectivity, but universality. That's what is meant by the cogito. That's what is meant by the transcendental unity of our perception. It is really the great philosophical attempt to pull a rabbit out of the hat, to square a circle, to do the trick. I mean, and every time I read it, it takes my breath away. I never get overexcited about it, but it's false. It was wrong. It was astoundingly wrong. And so the real question arose over and over and over again from the very moment that Kant published his critiques, is whether these two perspectives can be united, can be integrated into a coherent, self-validating form of life. Or, conversely, whether these two unquestionable achievements of modernity, and no one, these are the achievements of modernity. And then the question might become the thought that perhaps these two great achievements turn out to be radically incompatible with one another, hence demonstrating that modernity itself is a failed project. Now, for shorthand, I'll come back to the longhand in a second, for shorthand, we can say that Nietzsche is the great skeptic here. That if you read what Nietzsche calls nihilism, especially in the opening pages of The Will to Power, is an argument to the effect that the conditions of universalism make not just subjectivity, but above all, agency impossible. Literally impossible. That our idea of universalism is incompatible with practical reason. For those of you who have done technical and practical reason, the problem is practical reason is supposed to be intrinsically motivated. That is, to find something good is to find it good for you. And therefore, to act under an idea of something as morally required is not to ask the question, should I do it? To see that it's required is to be motivated to do it. And the problem with modern universalism is it detaches validity from motivational authority. Now, you can have lots of views about this. Nietzsche's view is, and this is why he says some of the stupid things he does, he's motivated to say them, because, namely, that, you know, it's all fictions, because he wants to get rid of universalism, and he feels he has to get rid of universalism to save human agency. It's not as if, you know, it's arbitrary. He just feels he has no other choice. If you go to University of Michigan, Peter Railton and Michigan utilitarians will say, we have to hold on to universalism and not tell anyone. People can have false beliefs about why they believe in morality, but we in Michigan know why. Which is sometimes called Whitehall universalism. That is, bureaucracy knows best. Okay. But it was not Nietzsche who was the first critic of note here. It was Rousseau, then Schiller, and Hölderlin, and the Romantics, who all claimed that rationalized reason, that's what I'm going to call this kind of universalism, rationalized reason. So it's the idea of some specific historical reason rationalized into some formalism, right? That's the idea, rationalized reason. So they all argue that rationalized reason, modern scientific reason, especially as it generated the capitalist economy and the mechanical state, the new and radical division of labor, and the fragmented modern subject, the new idea of a bureaucratic conception of administration, what I just mentioned, all of this, they said, was crushing the life out of individuals. This is the great sense of modernity as an antagonistic to individual life. All of this is, I think, brutally but brilliantly summarized in Schiller's Critique of Kant, where he argues that Kantian universalism not only dominates, represses, and excludes sensuous particularity, concrete sensuous life, not only, that is, to use the jargon that we now use in philosophy, not only does Kantian universalism operate a reduction of the other to the same, but the Kantian division of reason into three, the three critiques, theoretical reason, practical reason, and aesthetic reason, give us a fragmented conception of the individual. And that this fragmented conception of the individual is, in philosophy, a mirror image of the new specialization in the world of practice, the division of labor. So Kantian division of the subject is just the transcendental version of specialism, the division of labor. This is the critique of modernity that reaches fever pitch in the left Hegelians and, of course, in the Marx of the 1844 manuscripts and in his criticism ideology, where, of course, I want to go fishing in the morning and hopscotch in the afternoon and making cars at night, something like that. Right? Where, but it's that image of how do we get the subject back together again? Right? How do we get a concrete self? And, of course, you get a kind of ludicrous version in Marx, but the ludicrous version you should see as just an image of the experience of fragmentation that Hegel is here beginning to think about. Now, and here's the rub of all of this, where I'm getting to. Every one of these critics of modernity lodge their criticism from the perspective of the ideal form of life represented by classical Greek culture. That the Greek polis represented a form of life in which universality and individuality had been ideally synthesized. This is the moment, and it was kind of the whole story here, because the adoption of Greece actually came, as it were, backdoored, because the person who first did this idealization of the Greeks is Winckelmann in his Aesthetics, which is really antecedent to all of this, although not with out having this stuff in mind, and it was a certain adaptation of Winckelmann, who I think is much, much more important for all sorts of reasons. It created art history, for one thing, to all of this than is sometimes given credit for. But so the Greek alternative, even if it could not be achieved in the context of modern life, nonetheless showed what a successful version of the project of uniting those two points of view would look like. The elegiac nostalgia for Greek life, beautiful, lost, and irrecoverable, says Terry Pinkard. Very nice. Beautiful, lost, and irrecoverable. Was a weighty and constant feature of Hegel's philosophical culture. So in a profound sense, the perspective of Greek ethical life, be it Athens or Sparta, depending on your mood, whether you have a
democratic idealism or a Bush-like warrior
stoicism. It turns out that Athens was horrendous. But anyway, talk about warlike societies, just read Euripides. Anyway, nonetheless, this perspective of Greek ethical life,
and here's my point, really was conceived of as the rational successor to Kant's moral law.
Kantian rationalism begot in Schiller and Hödel and so on Greece. And therefore German idealism, right,
is a certain elaboration of that aestheticized conception of
the Greek polis. So the beautiful form of life, as first promoted by Winckelmann, Goethe and Schiller, and then Hödelin, was presented as the necessary alternative
to the broken middle of alienated modernity. Which is the reason why the shift from reason to spirit happens the way it does. That is, the thought of what spirit is, and I'm now going to tell you what spirit is, but the thought of what spirit is came into German philosophy via the image of Greek sociality.
So Hegel, now to give this all a much more philosophical cut, in turning back to the Greeks, is doing more than, and this is really what separates him from all these characters, but none of them were this simple, interrogating a critical perspective on modernity. He is, one more time, radically changing the topic of the phenomenology. And he's radically changing the topic because he's radically changing our conception of what the source or ground
for our being in the world is.
That is, this question is still the question of what is the absolute standpoint, that is, what is the ground or source of the possibility of my having a standing in the world that connects me to the world and gives me a world that's inhabitable.
The very same question that we started with sense certainty. Same question, how do I get in the world?
And the answer is now going to be spirit. So the argument runs is that in the champions of the Greek alternative, it represented, and I want to be clear about this, because this also motivates Hegel's procedure here, an aesthetic ideal. And I want to call it an aesthetic ideal because above all, what Greeks represented was an image of how universalism and particularism could be united. And therefore, it was the appeal of that image that was giving it its authority in these debates. And that what happens in each of these philosophies, and I can't go into the details, but each of them tried to then give some vindication of that immediacy of that beautiful image. And it always has to do with some notion of the Greeks being a spontaneous, natural, immediate, and unreflective form of life.
something like that.
We'll see what those terms mean in a moment. Now, Hegel sees something else entirely. He sees another contender for the idea of an absolute standpoint, that is, Geist as the successor notion to consciousness, self-consciousness, and reason. And this new concept is, of course, of spirit is a we that is an I and an I that is we. That is, by definition, just so we know where we are, spirit represents itself automatically some kind of connecting of universalism and subjectivity. Because we've already seen that the rational successor to abstract universalism is the concrete universalism of a we. Right? But a we that authorizes the lives of particular individuals who inhabit that we. Right? So we is Hegel's spirit, is Hegel's code word for a society. So the we that is an I and the I that is a we is the radical successor concept to transcendental unity of apperception. Because, again, the transcendental unity of apperception was supposed to be the correct connecting of universal and particular. Right? But it did so in that weird transcendental moment of synthesis. So now it's a we think that must accompany all our representations in order for that they be ours and therefore mine. And it is just this that Hegel argues, and I'm going to spin it out, in paragraphs 439 through 440, picking up and filling out what he had already adumbrated in paragraphs 349 through 351. So what Hegel's strategy here is to dignify the notion of social life into an absolute ground. And he does so through an internal account of the dialectical relation between structures of sociality on the one hand, laws, customs, institutions, and the like, and individual actions on the other. That is, by providing an account of the relationship between agency and structure. In a way in which no one before him had quite done. Obviously, there are hints of it. Aristotle's Politics talks about man as a political animal. There are hints of it in Herder and in Vico. But no one had really worked this out in any detail. Maybe in Fichte. So, paragraph 439, he gives you these extraordinary accounts of Geist, and you should hear, and he means you to hear, that the way he's going to talk about spirit, the way he's going to talk about social life, is the way other philosophers have talked about God. Right? So he says, its spiritual essence has already been designated as ethical substance, but spirit is the actual
duality of that substance. It is the self of actual consciousness to which it stands opposed, or rather which it opposes to itself as an objective, actual world. Spirit is a world, but a world which has completely lost the meaning for the self as something alien to it. Spirit being the substance, and now you get this whole theological type language. Spirit being the substance and the universal, self-identical, and abiding essence is the unmoved, solid ground and starting point for the action of all, and it is their purpose and goal, the in itself for every self-consciousness expressed in thought. The substance is equally the universal work produced by the action. So, I'll come back to how this works in a section, but that description is top-down. From social structure to the individual, he now does the exact opposite description from individuals back up. So, this substance is equal to the universal work produced by the action of all, and each as their unity and identity, for it is the being for self, the self-action. And so on and so forth. Goes on like that.
Well, in trying to get clear about this, I want to use an analogy, and the one that Merhal Westfall usefully uses. He says, when Hegel says spirit, think team spirit. And so, although this pains me, because if there's any constant in my life, the fact that since I can remember I hated the Yankees, let's think about the Yankees for a minute. As a model for spirit. Now, the point here is to say some obvious things. First, who one is defined by one's role in the team. Whether one is a player, or an administrator, or a fan, the team itself articulates the roles and possibilities of what it is to do actions at all. Right? So, the team has a meaning that cannot be reduced to what individuals do. So although it's true that Derek Jeter does things, right? He does things as a Yankee, and it's only as a Yankee playing a game that those activities have any meaning at all. Right? Just if I was standing here right now, lifted the baseball and hit it, I could not hit a home run, I could not win the World Series, or lose it. All those possibilities of action only occur in virtue of the antecedent structure represented by the roles and practices that are given by the fact that this is a baseball team. Furthermore, those roles and functions can be, although it pains some people, fulfilled by different individuals. So Randy Johnson may be, you know, very teed off that he is no longer the pitcher. But there can be other pitchers for the Yankees. It goes on. And furthermore, when someone is doing that activity, he is doing that activity for the sake of or realizing both, and I want to be clear, both his or her own private end, being the best
pitcher, batter, fielder he or she can be, and the goal of the society. And it's not an accident, just to remind you, that one of the pivotal moments in Hegel's thinking was his reading of Adam Smith, where he could discover how people could be, although seeking a private end, helping to further a complex economy. That in working for myself, I really am working for other people. So in producing things that are necessary for others and gaining benefit from others. So that model of the magic or invisible hand certainly is in the background here. And nearly, just again to remind you, that any individual member of a team thinks that although it would be nice to win the Most Valuable Player award, it would be much more valuable to win the World Series. That the success of the society, the team as a whole, its flourishing, is what makes any other flourishing worthwhile. Why would I flourish when all around me sink? Now, that's true, but of course the opposite is true as well. Namely, the team would be absolutely and literally nothing at all, without the individuals who fill those roles. That the notion of shortstop or the Yankees is not some impersonal structure sitting in a world all by itself, dictating or having, as Althusser would put it, bearers or traga, you know. It's simply that individuals doing things with other individuals under certain conditions, given certain types of rules that allow them to do that. Further, the Yankees are also the history of the Yankees. The Yankees are a community of the living and the dead. And present Yankees justify themselves in terms of that history, living up to it, being faithful to the practices of the past, or introducing new practices. Say the idea of having a closer. Pitchers in the old days, they finished the game themselves. There was no, right? As an improvement, as superior to the former practices. But the relationship is nonetheless one of dependency. So even the Yankees are a community of the living and the dead. And a reflective understanding of themselves as such a community. Now that, in broad terms, is what Hegel means when he says that spirit is a we that is an I, and an I that is a we. That is, that the we of the Yankees is realized in the performances of individual players. And the individual players, when they act, as it turns out, as members of, and in relationship to, their role as being a Yankee. So spirit is a we that is an I. It is the history of that we that is an I, and an I that is a we. And it is a knowledge of itself as that history. That's roughly going to be what this chapter is going to demonstrate. Come to that moment of realization about all of those features internally
even though we've now discovered them externally. That is, we have to understand the conditions under which we have made the discovery that we have already just made. How is it we have come to understand ourselves this way? And if this is the truth about who we are, the rational force of that truth of who we are cannot be abstract. That is, cannot have the status that it has right now. The vindication of the discovery of spirit only will occur by tracing that history and showing that it compels the discovery of itself as the ground and authority of our united reflective life. So, when he sketches these features of it out, going back to the middle of the chapter on reason, paragraph 349, Hegel says, this ethical substance, taken in its abstract universality, is only law in the form of thought, but it is no less immediately actually self-consciousness, for it is custom. The single individual consciousness. So the thought here is, how does spirit get a grip on life? How do these two sides relate to one another? Practices and customs. Practices, customs, laws, the rules that govern everyday life. They are themselves the bearers of the relationship between and the embodiment or sedimentation of spirit as both the we in relationship to the I. Paragraph 351, he says, about a third of the way down the paragraph, the labor of the individual for his own needs is just as much a satisfaction of the needs of others as of his own. And the satisfaction of his own needs he obtains only through the labor of others. I mean, Smith really did dig deep into Hegel's thinking about how individual and society are related. This is a great Smithian passage, but he's thinking about society generally when he thinks about it. He thinks this is kind of true more or less of all our social practices. As the individual in his individual work already unconsciously performs a universal work, so again, he also performs the universal work as his conscious object. The whole becomes, as a whole, his own work, for which he sacrifices himself, and precisely in so doing, receives back from it his own self. And then a sentence down. This unity of being for another, or making oneself a thing, from the point of view, notice, it's about perspective here. From the point of view of the whole, I am just a thing or bearer. But that's just one of the points of view. The unity of being for another or making oneself a thing, and conversely, of being for self, this universal substance, speaks its universal language in the customs and laws of the nation. The we, which is the universality, is born by the customs and laws of the nation. Now, one further comment here. notice how, if this is all correct, how this notion of Geist ties in with the discourse on recognition from the chapter on self-consciousness. To have a role or place in society is, and I want to put it this way, is both to be recognized, cognized as having a place, and valued accordingly, esteemed, and the like. So one's being in that social role is dependent on another, indeed, finally, on the whole society, because only the whole society legitimates that role, and other people recognize you as satisfying or failing to satisfy that role, right? What we call student evaluations. But that these recognitions so that you are, in this sense, absolutely dependent on Geist itself for having any standing at all as a human being. Without it, you are literally nothing. That's why Hegel adopts Schelling and Spinoza's notion of substance here and says this is the unmoved mover. This is the unmoved mover. Now, in the precise terms of such recognition, what it feels like and what it is like to be so recognized will vary with the kinds of roles that are available in each society. And for example, Antigone is going to discover that a role she thought valuable will suddenly not feel so good. And similarly for Creon. He doesn't have a fun time either. Nonetheless, and I want to underline, this account of how one inhabits the world by inhabiting a community of the living and the dead explains why traditional societies are so resilient. Traditional societies are not resilient because they have a god or because they have religion or any of those sorts of things. Rather, it's because they are above all communities of the living and the dead. That's what religion really represents for Hegel, as I'll show later on. And therefore, they offer each individual a role and a function, and hence a generalized place in the world, which makes the world as a whole and one's place in it and in relationship to it intelligible. Think of it this way. Better a bat boy with the Yankees than nothing at all. Well, we often have a problem understanding why people tolerate hierarchical societies. And I'm trying to get you to imagine that hierarchical societies can be very powerful and satisfying in deep inward ways. Right? And therefore, getting people to see why they are dominating, why they are alienating from the inside may be very difficult. Or to put it another way, that modernity, by its forgetfulness of Geist, and that's what all this is about, right, generates a terrible, terrible experience of worldlessness that people rebel against. Now, What follows from all this, therefore,
Hegel puts at the top of paragraph 440, spirit is thus self-supporting, absolute, real being. That's the first thing. There ain't anything else. I want to be absolutely clear. And Hegel says it over and over again. He says if people are determined not to believe him, this is what he says, spirit, what we've just seen it is. The spirit of the Yankee. Absolute real being. That's it for Hegel. And furthermore, next sentence, all previous shapes of consciousness are abstract forms of it. Everything that we've read to here is simply an abstraction from a moment of spirit. Some moment of it that is in all moments of it, sense certainty and the like, or some moment of it that is tied to a particular moment of its history. So we will see that Stoicism belongs to the Roman world. The Roman world! Stoicism is part of a world formation.
It is as if I may put it this way, all previous philosophy had tried to make sense of playing a game by saying just being a hitter or a pitcher was
outside of any institutional practices. So it's as if philosophers were trying to say what morality was trying to think about being a pitcher, but forgot about baseball. Philosophy is that kind of abstraction from the world and institutional practices that give its own concepts purport and meaning.
Or conversely, to say that
baseball is nothing but the individualistic modern point of view, people doing things, as if the notion of institution was fully reducible to the practices of individuals, with no notion of rules, customs, laws, etc., and their way in which they integrate and provide structures of integration for the lives of individuals.
Hegel is the first philosopher who thinks philosophy in terms of institution. So idealism all the way down for Hegel means really it's institutions all the way down. Now there's one further thought here before we get on to the actual Antigone argument. Namely, that this movement to a new topic, namely how we must now think about these forms of life, we have to ask the question, how are we to think about these new forms of life? And how is it that one begets another? How is the movement of consciousness going to occur? Surely if there's a change of topic, there has to be, as it were, a change in the way that the dialectic operates, or what dialectical experience means. And now,
lo and behold, speaking of rabbits and hats, we get back to what I was talking about
in the first 2 weeks of the course, the causality of fate. Oh, gosh, all those blank faces. The what? 20 weeks ago, you're having to remember the causality of fate. Let's have a break there.
As I see these faces of alarm, try to drop something familiar, like a lead balloon.
And we'll pick up there after the break.